I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, welcome back to Soul Sisters. I'm Jessie Katz.
A little sing-songy. I'm Dara Golub.
I should leave the sing-songing to you.
Yeah. I love it when you do it.
Oh, I try. So today's episode is with a very cool artist whose band has been blowing up my everything for a while since her new album came out. The band is called Japanese Breakfast, and her name is Michelle Zauner. And I took a stab at seeing if she could come in and join us, and she was available. So that's always nice when that happens.
Yeah. You haven't seen them live, right?
No. Mm-mm. No, we should do that.
Yeah, I would love to.
I think it'd be a very cool experience.
Yeah. The record is so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very immersive experience. So I'm curious how that will translate.
Right. Totally. Yeah. She was awesome. She has a very interesting way of working that she talked to us about. She suffers from a problem I think most of us wish we suffered from, which is that she completes things too quickly instead of taking her time with them. Her work obviously doesn't suffer from it. But I think, just as a way of living, maybe she wishes she was better at slowing down.
Yeah, which is just fascinating and makes me very jealous.
Right.
Because
someone who's been working on something for 10 years, does the idea of completion sound nice to you?
I would give my right arm to be to
completed.
To complete. But we talked a lot about that. Just sort of does it bump up against the idea of perfectionism, which I think a lot of artists struggle with, and just the idea of sitting down and creating something at a given time, without waiting for the muse and the inspiration and the right moment and the right weather and the right sweater and just totally. Everything to be perfect.
I've been hearing different things from our guests lately about that. We've had guests who are
talking about
I can't just sit down and expect something to come out. I have to wait for inspiration. And then others who are like,
this is my job.
Exactly. I sit down every day and see what happens, which has always been my philosophy because I think that's a good way for artists to procrastinate is to say that they're waiting for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
But you can usually find it if you force yourself to just sit. I mean, it will, I think, happen more often than if you're going about your life being distracted by everything else.
Yeah.
At least in my personal experience. I guess everyone's different.
Well, there's a certain extent to which you, have to do that.
Yeah.
If you are going to make it not just I don't know if it's a difference between, making your art and, making your work. There's some sort of distinction between when you just sit and let it come and then you pour it out versus, intentionally making it happen. I don't know. The songwriting a day challenge that we talked about with Michelle is something that I think many artists have done and tried, and just giving yourself that framework can be hugely helpful. I've never done anything like that.
Maybe we should do something like that.
I would love that.
What would be what would you want to create in a finite amount of time?
Well,
if you and I did this together.
I mean, I would love to start writing again.
Yeah.
Writing criticism.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. When we first met and started talking and doing podcasting and stuff, I was very interested in that.
True.
And it's a discipline that I don't have.
Mm.
But I would like to.
So you would give yourself a topic.
Yeah.
And then we would have 24 hours.
Yeah, which is your job. Like, you are able to do that.
No, but I, like, there's a play that I really want to write, and I've been doing the outlining and figuring out the characters, you know, but I have yet to actually start writing the fucking thing. So this actually really appeals to me.
Right. And the outline is the key, though. Isn't
yeah.
it? Like, if you have a solid outline, it kind of just gets filled in.
That's what they teach you in school. It's true. It does help. Because if you don't outline, you will get to the third act and realize you're totally fucked. You didn't give yourself the tools you need to finish the story.
Right. Well, a play is very different than something, say, like an article.
An essay or an article.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm always amazed when, like, you know... We talked about Game of Thrones last time, but I'm just obsessed. You know, the show ends and, like, an article, an analysis article comes out in, like, the next hour.
Yeah.
Like, how does someone – and it's beautifully written.
Right.
And it seems almost flawless. So it's like, where does – that's
– I think that's because people that's already – yeah. And they already have thoughts and opinions about the themes
right.
and all of that. And so, like, the details of what happened in that particular episode probably just – fill in the dots
yeah
to the framework that they already have built in their mind.
Okay, that makes sense.
I don't know,
kind of have to have a running start.
Yeah, but I think we should do it. Maybe 48 hours.
Okay,
maybe like a Friday night to a Sunday
night. I'm already getting anxious just at the thought of this.
I'm getting so excited because we'll have something
because we each have so much else to work on.
Like, I know,
ourselves these kind of homework.
Yeah.
I like it. I like the
but
idea.
But this is the kind of thing that's always hanging over me that gives me my constant low-level stress is, like, I haven't written the play yet. I haven't written the play yet. It's not the other stuff that I actually have to do because I'll get it done because I have to do it. But it's the stuff
same.
I want to do.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is it? It's like if you want to get something done, ask a busy person or something.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
Like, the busier you are, the more likely you are to get something done.
Right.
If I don't write it down on my list, it's not happening.
Or what I've been learning is ask someone who has a young child because they've learned how to manage their
time.
Oh, my
God. How the hell?
Yeah.
But
they say it's made them more efficient and productive with their time.
I don't understand.
All right. So let's get knocked up and then give ourselves 40
hours.
We got it all figured out. Boom. I love these intros.
Oh, God.
We really unlock life.
I'm spitzing.
Just at the thought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Okay,
well,
so
anyway.
Michelle's given us a lot to think about.
Yes, exactly.
And
she will. And
yet, you put
too.
On her music, you don't have to think about anything. It's just beautiful.
It is beautiful. But the lyrics are about a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that kind of music where you can zone out and just enjoy the sound of it.
Definitely.
Or listen and... question the purpose of writing your life and existence.
Your very existence. Yeah,
yeah, which is the best kind of art.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. So Michelle's honor of Japanese breakfast on Soul Sisters. The inner workings of Dara's mind.
Yeah.
Sure.
No, just that this is really beautiful. My cousin's dog was, like, now taken to eating its poop and then vomiting.
I experienced a thing recently where I was babysitting my friends. It doesn't involve poop. But it was just eating its own vomit. It felt bad that it vomited in my car, and then it started trying to eat it.
Oh, that's like
dogs
nice.
Always want to eat their vomit.
But I think it's really.
You think it's because your dog feels bad? I think they just really like it.
I think I maybe give it the benefit of the doubt that I felt like it felt really bad and wanted to fix it.
That's a nice
maybe.
Way to look at it.
I don't know your dog. I guess that's possible.
I mean, I was babysitting this dog, and I wanted to believe that that's why she was
doing
that. It was really gross.
No, the second my dog... So, whatever, this is so gross. When my dog starts throwing up, which is always in the middle of the night, he'll, like, sit up in bed. I'll be like, are you going to throw up? And then he'll, like, take himself down at the floor. And then he'll, like, start to heave. And I have to perch over him so I can whisk him away the second it comes up. Or he'll inhale all of it.
Never getting a dog.
God. That's
they're
so
foul.
Gnarly.
Oh, man,
and then they lick
foul.
Your face.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And you're like, I love you.
No.
Well, this is a
Welcome.
New way to open the show. Michelle, what's going on? How are you? Are you nauseous?
I made it surreal.
Yeah.
I think I needed something gross to, like, ground me in this moment because I've been so frazzled today. I actually feel better now.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
so
nothing gets you focused like poop
like
vomit.
Scatological.
It's the best
weirdness.
Way to collect your thoughts.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming in. Are you touring these days? Or are you stationary.
I have a miraculous 3 weeks off this month.
Oh, okay.
And then I'm pretty much gone for the year once September 6th rolls around.
I reached out at the right moment.
Yep.
Yeah. Because I discovered you recently because Tegan and Sarah were tweeting up a storm about you guys. And I was like, who's that? Okay. And then your new album came out, and then like my entire Twitter sphere, was just like buzzing about your album. So then I got into it, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah, and I was awesome. Like, I wonder if she can come on the podcast. And here you are. Here dreams I come am. True. Yes. Look at that. You never know until you ask.
Yeah.
It's fortuitous timing. Mm-hmm. So you're about to go on tour?
Yeah, it's our first headlining tour. Whoa. We've been doing direct support for the last year and a half, so it kind of feels like you're always the bridesmaid and, like, my wedding's coming up.
Right.
So 5 weeks, yeah.
So does that analogy fit? Like, are you feeling nervous, stressed?
Definitely, right, yeah.
All the wedding things?
All the bride things.
I feel, like, simultaneously really excited and also nervous because you get, like, all of a sudden all of the shows are your responsibility, you know, to have people come out.
Right.
And for a while, and still, it's always, every time I go somewhere, I'm like, there's no one that's going to be here. And then I'm like, oh, whoa, all these people have come to this thing.
Yeah.
So this is the first time I'm getting, like, ticket counts every week of just like, you sold 5 tickets to, you know, like 5 more tickets in like Salt Lake City, Utah.
Yeah.
And it's always really crazy and really stressful. And sometimes it feels really like it's going really well. And sometimes it's like really nerve wracking. But I think it'll be really great to actually get to play our full catalog. And it's the first time that we have 2 albums out. And so I'm excited to have like the full range, because I think that when you play direct support, you're always just playing the hits, and so it's nice that like when you go out, people are actually there to see you, and you can play a little bit more of the slower jams and like a diverse catalog.
Yeah. I've never heard that term direct support before. Is that a
very
new
very
word
common
for
term.
Opening for somebody, or is it different?
Well, there's, I mean, on a lot of the tours that I've been on are like package 3-band tours. So there's like first of 3, and then direct support, and then the headliner. So I was direct support for Mitski, and then Porches, and then Alex G on pretty much like the same 5-week circuit in the exact same direction of like down the East Coast, like first DC, then go all the way around, and then
same
Boston,
venues.
And then pretty much the same venues. Yeah. And every time you go there, it's always like the same like staff, and and this new headlining tour that we're doing in September is like also pretty much the same.
Really?
We always play the Masquerade in Atlanta. We always play. Crocodile in Seattle. Always play Music Hall of Williamsburg. So it's a lot of like the same places.
Well, that's
so how do you feel about that tour life? So that, what is this, like the 3rd year of Japanese Breakfast?
This is actually the 2nd year of Japanese Breakfast. It's like a super, I mean, I've been playing music for 5 years, and I was in another band that did mostly just DIY touring, like basements and, you know, getting paid in cans of soup and whatever.
Little Big League, that
is. Yeah, Little Big League. We did that for like 3 years, and then Japanese Breakfast was like a totally unexpected project that just, I didn't really intend for it to do as well as it did. I was happily surprised when it did. But yeah, it's pretty much only been alive since like March 2016.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. I don't understand
accidental or unintentional.
No, but like how you like, put these 2 albums out within a year of each other. That is so insane.
Yeah. I'm like kind of a workaholic, and I write pretty quickly, and I'm not
Yes, I read some interview where you were talking about that and how like it's helpful for you to work with people who can slow you down.
Yeah.
Because you love to complete things, which is the opposite from what you hear from a lot of artists.
Definitely.
Or like a lot of any of us.
That's a blessing.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, like anything, it's like a blessing and a curse, you know. I think that for me, especially moving forward, I want to really take my time and explore how to make my tone really great and how to improve as a musician, because when you've been doing it for a while, your progress, it feels so slow. And so it's just finding new ways to explore I don't know, your creativity or whatever. But for me, I like projects to get done. I like seeing the end result. And so it's always, I have a ton of friends who are just amazing songwriters that never put out anything because they just get in this head loop where they're just always trying to improve it. And I think for me, an album is a lot like an archive of just like where I'm at in my life, both in skill set and, you know, emotional state. So it was nice to have, usually when I co-produce an album, at least in the case of the last two, it's nice having a collaborator who really is like, no, but we needed to spend more time on this part or whatever.
Do you think that bumps up against a sort of perfectionism? Like, is that the opposite of that? Like, if you're like, okay, this is where I'm at right now, it might not be like exactly perfect. I could spend another 3-6 months on this, but I'm going to put it out and I'm done.
Yeah. I think that at some point you have to... I think that the most important thing that you have to learn as an artist is to let go. And I think that I'm not proud of like anything I've created at a certain point in time. It's kind of like it needs to go in this cycle where like as soon as I make it, for the first like 2 or 3 weeks, I'm like, I love this so much. And then after that, it's like, oh, this sucks. And then, but you know, you have to let it go. And then another like 2 or 3 years go by, and then you look back on it and you're like, oh, this was pretty good for that time period.
Wow. It's very true. I empathize with that feeling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. Do you feel like those first two albums, though, kind of go together?
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. Psychopomp was just such a raw and vulnerable time for me. I had lost my mom, and it was written 2 months after she passed away. And so a lot of the songs are just feeling like really like confused about what I was supposed to feel or like processing that kind of emotion.
Did you decide like, I'm grieving, I need to give myself something to do, I'm going to write an album? Or were you just super inspired to write an album out of those feelings?
Excuse me. It was like mostly the former, I think. Mm-hmm. I was living, I had moved back to Eugene, Oregon, where I grew up, and I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I had to quit my band and leave my partner and, you know, quit my job and all the stuff and move back to help support my mom through her chemo and then, you know, unfortunately have to be there when she passed away. So then after that, I was just kind of stuck in the house that I grew up in that was, you know, filled with memories of my mother and, you know, that whole house is just, you know, her doing in a lot of ways. And my dad was so freaked out, and I kind of was just stuck there for 6 months helping him, you know, put stuff away and being an emotional support system for him, that I needed to carve out like some kind of distance and space for myself. So there was like, you know, little cottage on the bottom of like my dad's 5 acres of land in the woods of Eugene, Oregon. I had, you know, a Bon Iver moment and like, you know, just carved out some project for myself, something to focus on that wasn't just like surrounded in darkness, to just kind of try to process and sort out what I was feeling. So yeah, I mean, I really had no intention. I thought I would trick like a label eventually to like put out, you know, 500 copies of a vinyl that would sell over the course of like the next 10 years of my life. And I explicitly said I didn't want to tour again, and then
you made music and said I don't want to tour on it.
Yeah, I told the label I didn't want to tour it. Because touring is so hard.
Well, what would you do?
I would just, like, operate, like, a web store in, like, the woods. Like, and then
like, you wanted to make music but not perform it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I just couldn't. It just wasn't ever financially. It just didn't make sense financially from what I was used to doing.
What was your financial situation before?
Just, like, working at a restaurant, going on tour for 3 weeks, getting fired from the restaurant, like scrambling to find another restaurant job for 2 weeks, and then so on and so forth. Like coming home with, you know, $1,000 in the hole because, you know, even though I was sleeping on floors, like gas was more expensive than, you know, whatever. It was just not realistic. And then when I got offered the Mitski tour, we actually like had a guarantee every night. There were people that were actually in the room every night. We were selling merch, and it was enough for us to come home at least like not completely broke.
But when you made that first album and you said, I don't really want to tour on it, were you going to get a day job?
Yeah, I got a day job in New York. I was like working as a sales assistant at an advertising company. And I was just like, I just want the routine of 9 to 5 because I'd never done it in a really serious way, because I always kind of was like juggling music and something else to pay the bills. And this time I just wanted to really not focus on music anymore and just like work a normal 9 to 5 job.
How did you find that?
I hated it. But, you know, I had never really, like, put in the time, because especially when you work, like, a 9-to-5 job in New York, it's never, like, you get out at 5 or you get out at 6. It's always
I've never met someone who actually did that 5 part.
Yeah. It's weird. Like, there's not this weird, like, opposite musical chairs where, like, you don't want to be the first person to get out of the office, mm-hmm. and there's this tremendous guilt, even if it's, like, half an hour after the time that you're supposed to be able to leave. Like, you're just, you don't want to be that first person. And I just hated it.
There was this great piece in the Times this past week about how we go on vacation and then we make a point to answer all of our emails to prove to everyone that, like, we're not really on vacation.
Yeah.
Like, God, we work so hard that we can't stop answering our emails.
Totally.
Even though we put up the out of office message, but then we'll, like, follow up on our out of office 5 minutes so after fucked. That person's gotten it. Yeah. It's terrible.
It's very gross.
Yeah. Anyway.
So how did the Mitski tour come into play?
I was a big Mitski fan, and I saw her play I think it was a CMJ show at St. Vitus, and, you know, kind of like fangirled out in the way that I think Mitski experiences a lot in her life. And she was very sweet to me, and we exchanged numbers, and she was like, oh, I hope you don't mind. I, like, submitted you to be direct support, and I was like, holy shit. And then...
You weren't on a label or anything?
No, I was on, like, a small indie label based out of Frostburg, Maryland, called Yellow K Records, and I had played, you know, a couple shows in New York just for fun, as solo, and I didn't really have a live band together, and we had just agreed to play South by Southwest, and then one solo show turned into, like, 7 full band showcases, and then the Mitski tour was offered to us, and then I was kind of like, well, it's time to quit my job and try this again. It's not the right time to, like, quit this, I guess.
So that was 2016?
Yeah.
Wow. And so the album was out?
The album wasn't even out. The album came out in April, and then I went to South by Southwest in March, but off of, like, 3 singles that had come out.
Wow. Crazy. Mm-hmm.
Very crazy.
Yeah. when did you start writing the second album?
October of 2016.
You are a workhorse.
Yeah. I'm really curious about the songwriting a day challenge, and I wonder how that played in. So I read about this.
Yeah.
That I think this was before either album.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, yeah. So, I think that was like 2014 or something, or 2013.
Okay, which might help us understand why, like, we're like, that was so fast. Mm, so you, like, had a bank of tons of songs, right, that, like, were kind of there, like, percolating?
Yeah, I like playing sick games with myself where I, like, create some kind of weird challenge to pursue. So at the time, I had, like, 3 jobs, was in Little Big League, but, like, wanted to write more and felt kind of, like, in this creative rut. And I came up with this idea to write and record a song every day for the month of June. And so, and then put them out. And so there are, like, 30 really lo-fi demos that existed. And I did it again, I think, a year later for a week. And so I had, like, you know, about 37 demos to draw from. And they were kind of just bare-bone structures, usually just, like, a verse and a chorus. But it was enough, like, to be a good jumping-off point because, you know, you just repeat the verse and the chorus, maybe throw a bridge in there, and it's a song. And then it kind of gave me more time to focus on production and arrangement once, like, I jumped off of, like, that structure.
Right. So that comes from a different place than where Psychopomp came from, in terms of you had tremendous inspiration, tremendous reason to write, versus, okay, I have to write every single day. What was your inspiration? What were you drawing from? And was it a lot harder to do the songwriting,
like,
then?
Bonkers ideas. That,
like, just like,
there's like
whatever.
A song about a Pegasus or something. Like, just like weird stuff.
So you didn't, like, edit yourself. You're like, I think of this and I'm going to write a song.
Yeah, it was kind of like an exercise in forgiveness of just, like, you know, first choice, best choice. Like, what I don't think that's a saying. There's some saying that's kind of, like, along those lines.
Right.
But,
yeah.
Like, it was kind of just, like, you know, I think that a lot of times you get caught up in just, like, I can't write any more songs in the key of G. I can't write any more songs in drop D. No more capos. Like, all of this, like, these weird rules that you put out for yourself, and it was kind of just an exercise of just, like, you have an hour, like, get it done, and then see what happens, you know? And sometimes it was surprisingly, I like most of those songs. I think there's, like, 4 songs out of 30 that I just despise.
Two on your album now, on the new album, are from that time period?
Maybe. Right? I don't remember. Okay. Probably. Yeah. I recycled a lot of stuff. Probably more than
I will
that,
tell
honestly.
You. Yeah. I know.
Dara does her research.
That's awesome.
Do you know Wish songs?
Yeah, I do.
Cool. Alice.
I think it's Boyish. Is that right?
Mm. Boyish, actually. Yeah. Boyish was recycled from that era.
Boyish and, I don't know. I had it.
The title track is from there. And I think Roadhead might have also been on there.
Should have.
Yeah.
That's funny. I have a note to myself about those two songs.
Great.
About you write. Well, first of all, I just want to say I love your songwriting because your songs mm-hmm. feel like they have very specific subjects. Or like you're telling a specific story, or there's something that you're getting at in each song. Like it's like a collection of short stories almost, if you want to look at it that way. Those two songs are examples of songs that are talking about ways that we can really fuck ourselves over with sex,
yeah,
or use it for the wrong reasons. Boyish has an amazing lyric: "I can't get you off my mind. I can't get you off in general," which is just like so clever, and also like I get that. That's awesome. Yeah. So what was my question out of that? I just was like reveling in those songs today.
Just that, yeah.
Well, first of all, I was wondering, did you study writing? Are you a writer? Like a creative writer?
I studied creative writing in college.
You did?
And I think that, you know, when you study creative writing in college, a lot of times you're reading a lot of short fiction because you just don't have enough time to tackle the novel.
Right.
So yeah, I was introduced, you know, neither one of my parents went to college, so a lot of what I was exposed to was in college. So I read a lot, you know, I had particularly had a mentor, Daniel Torde, who taught creative writing that I just was obsessed with. And
where'd you go?
I went to Bryn Mawr College.
Okay.
so yeah, I studied a lot of short fiction, and I think that it taught me a lot about writing.
Yeah. You can tell.
Yeah, I think that, and I think I brought it a bit into my songwriting, in the sense that just, you know, you have a very in the same way that with short fiction, you have a limited amount of time,
mm-hmm.
largely either like 2.5 to 3.5 minutes of time,
right,
to discuss like a thing. So it's generally good to like start from like a small moment and expand upon that small moment. So I think a lot of the songs kind of follow that narrative of just, you know, with Roadhead, it's like envisioning someone giving Roadhead and you know, kind of taking a microscope to that moment and sort of blowing it up to see what does that mean for two people and what does that symbolize and mm-hmm. how does that affect, you know, your life or whatever.
Yeah. So you do work out, I mean, I'm not assuming that certain things come from your real experience and certain things don't, but I'm assuming like you do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You draw from past relationships in a lot of these songs. You're also married to someone in your band now, right?
Yeah, I hired him.
Yeah.
I hired him a couple...
Because he came at a good price.
Yeah. It's available.
Yeah, exactly.
It got to the point where the band was doing well enough that we're going to either be apart all the time or I could put him in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And we could finally like afford to not live in complete squalor if he joined the band. And, you know, we were away from each other for a majority of last year. And, you know, I felt like I could, I can tour forever now because I just, you know, this person who
so
is
your
my
life
home
is, with traveling
is
with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. So
that
it's
makes
nice.
Sense
yeah.
to me.
It's unfair actually, to the other members of the band, but.
We talked to a lot of people who are in a serious relationship with one of the dudes in the band, mm-hmm. actually. This is becoming a theme.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, totally makes sense to me. Like, of course, that would solve a lot of problems. But I was going to ask, because, like, okay, if I were an artist and I was writing songs about past relationships, I think I would generally want to be coy about, like, I'm not going to talk about who this song is about, or I'm not going to say, like, what actually happened to me. But if you're playing these songs with your partner, how specific do you get with him?
I think he's, like, pretty aware.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of the songs are about him, and it's pretty funny when we're sound checking to sing the lyrics a cappella, like, into the microphone, and I can't imagine, like, how much he shakes his head about it. But I think, I mean, we have a really good relationship, and I think that he is pretty understanding that, you know, my perspective is pretty melodramatic in the songs, so
right, artistic license.
Yeah He doesn't judge, he understands.
Yeah. But I just mean, even like, does he, yeah, I don't know, like, are you able to say, like, I'm not gonna get into that?
You mean like who, what, if
I mean, he would
about...
never ask, you know.
Yeah,
he would never ask or want to know, and I think right. that he kind of chooses what he like researches, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
and I
yeah.
don't think that he does.
That's smart. Not even about romantic things. I just feel like if I was in a band with my partner, they might be like, what is this about? And feel like they had extra license for me to explain that to them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a really secretive person anyway.
Yeah.
So,
that's
like,
true.
It doesn't really, I'm a tell all kind of gal. Yeah. So, as much as I would like to be like the mysterious artist type, I am not.
Yeah.
Both in like interview and
right.
personal
right.
life. It's
I
not very right. different.
I read the All Songs Considered on NPR. Like, you basically
yeah.
went track by track mm-hmm. and explained.
Which is dumb.
Which
I don't know. I kind of wish I didn't do that. But
yeah, I do wonder like how you felt about that. I was curious.
I mean, for me, I'm just like, they want to know. So I'm going to tell them.
Right, and you don't
like the question.
I found it interesting too, but as an artist, you're literally asked to sort of like give, and you don't, you know, you're not expected to be like jokey and kind of evasive and like kind of funny. Like, NPR wants you to be like straight to the point.
Yeah.
You know, this is what this is about, and I actually have questions based on that, which
yeah,
I feel
a lot
like
of
is
people
a little
do,
bit
yeah.
unfair to you, just a little bit, because whatever, you're not a mysterious person, but like you want a little bit of like, let the listener, you know, take that
for sure
for
yeah
what it is.
I do think that like there's you know, I think that there are listeners who would rather not know and rather that information not be available, because I think that there are some things that I could have said about the songs that ruined it, you know, ruined people's interpretation of it or whatever.
Right, and that's the internet, you don't have to read it
for
you know
sure,
like
yeah.
they don't, you're people who don't want to.
But for me, like, when I was growing up, like, the artists that really stuck with me throughout the years were artists that I felt like I personally knew. And I think a lot of it was because they were, like, you know, super transparent in interviews. Not because they made a conscious choice to be, but just because that was, like, inherent to
like,
the person.
Like,
or like, I remember, like, watching, like, Sean Marshall from Cat Power interviews, like, when I was younger. And just, like, her in a radio station just, like, you know, talking a mile a minute about like tricking her record label into giving her an advance to like follow some guy to Australia or something like that. And I was just like, you know, you just feel so close to that artist and you feel like you know them. And yeah, I just, that's just what I like, I
yeah.
guess. And that's
yeah.
how
that's
I am.
Why we host this podcast,
yeah.
I think.
Exactly.
So we can get the stories.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about an interview I read with you where you were asked about working in a male-dominated industry, and you said sometimes you don't even notice it because of who you surround yourself with. Could you explain what that means exactly? Because if you have figured out a way to make that better for yourself, I think that's really great advice that you could give.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky, and I think that like the time period that this band started getting attention was a time period where I think that a lot of press and other musicians and you know, the general public were trying, or not the general public, but at least like the indie rock world was trying to kind of push up you know, marginalized voices, and yeah. and I feel very much a part of that community and feel very comfortable within it. So you know, like the artists that I listen to and really value are largely women of color, and you know, those are the people I've toured with largely, and the people I want to bring on tour and play shows with and talk to and, you know, text about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that I think that things are slowly changing, and you know, I think that it's really cool to be vocal about it, and now if, you know, you have like a shitty sound person that's like a condescending asshole to you, like I said, like you play the same venues like, you know, four times within the year, like, and that same sound person is always there, and if that sound person was a condescending asshole to a girl on the tour, like, I'm never going to work with that person again, and I'm going to be very vocal about it to the booking agents and to the venues that we never want to play there again, unless they fire this person or they never work our shows. And I think that's awesome. Yeah. There are a lot of, like, really powerful young women who also feel the same way and are starting to do that, and there's nothing more exhausting than having spent maybe, you know, 250 days on the road and have someone not treat you like you're a professional and that you do this every single day.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing point, because we do hear that, which is something I had never thought about before we started doing this podcast, which is all the men that you have to work with when you're a touring musician or even a recording musician that are not people that we as the audience ever see, but they're generally the people who are doing the sound, who are in the recording booth, who are doing all the technical things, mm-hmm. who are very crucial to your day-to-day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get a lot of that kind of misogyny from. Definitely. Is from those people.
Mm-hmm. It's cool to hear you say that you will say something.
Yeah.
And, like, even protest, like,
and
not
take a stand about it. Yeah,
that's...
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's tough in certain situations because, like, especially when you're a support band, you don't want to, like, ruin anyone's time or, you know, the show is not about you, you know.
But now,
and if you're not nice, if the sound person doesn't like you, you're fucked. Like,
yeah, I mean, we're unfortunately not quite in a place where, like, we can afford to bring a front of house because it's really quite expensive to bring another person. But I absolutely want to see more women in front of house positions, and I think that it's becoming more more present, and a lot of it has to do with just like venues trusting women and that they're capable of doing that, and so often
it's such a crazy thing
that's not the case. I mean, I've met like a tremendous amount of women that do sound that are tremendous at their jobs, and I definitely want to see more of that and work with more of them. I know that when the last time we played Music Hall and Bowery, there was a very, very diverse staff, which is really cool.
Do you know Marie Kim?
Yeah, totally. She's awesome.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford her.
Okay.
I definitely reached out to her.
I just recommended her to you.
Oh, yeah. Right. She's awesome.
She's amazing, yeah. A couple of the songs kind of that from this album are touch on this. I don't know if it's true or if this was kind of what you said to NPR, but that like Roadhead was about a guy who, aside from being about what it's obviously about on the surface, but below the surface, a guy that made you feel like you're not cut out for a career in music, and how in Diving Woman, a feeling of feeling guilty for touring and not like staying home and have a family. Mm-hmm. Like, were those feelings that's not so much from the technical people, but that's more from like your friends or peers or people closer to you that I think would make you feel that way. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there was a particular person that made me feel that way. It was just kind of like, you know, brief, like,
society
asides in conversation of just like, when is this over, you know? And I think that it's also, I mean, you know, beyond just being a woman, just like, I think it's being a musician just seems like a really selfish profession. Like, no one would say to an accountant, like, you know, but when are you going to, you know, like...
when are you going to pick up a paintbrush?
Yeah, but, like, what do you actually do?
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's very hard to convince people, like, that this is an actual job that I get paid to do. And especially with older people and, you know, family in Korea recently. But, like, who is the company that's paying you to do this? It was, like, very difficult conversation to navigate. But yeah, I think it was also just largely myself of just like, I feel really shitty being away from my partner for a year, and I love my job and I love doing this every day, but I also feel so bad and like, this is not sustainable for us to be apart for so long, and just like feeling really guilty about that. And what, you know, when do you make the decision to fix that?
You know, it's funny when I was looking at the tracks on that album every time I've gone to play it over the last however long since it came out, I never put that phrase together as being what it means. Roadhead? I think I read those Roadhead? Two words completely separately in my mind, and it wasn't until I saw the NPR thing I was like, oh, Roadhead.
Is it like a head made out of a road?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like,
it
my
wasn't,
mind is on the road
it didn't
as touring musician.
To me to read any of your song titles literally like that.
Yeah, I mean that song is like I think I like
it's on the road.
It's like when I didn't get transparent for like the first year that it was amazing. Out, and then I was like, oh, because it's apparent he's trans, like, right?
Yeah. Whoa. I think that that's kind of just like my style is like, you know, little boy, like, you know, sexual innuendo humor. It's just like always makes its way onto an album. It's like, ha ha. Yeah. But I think that. I think that there's always that song is sort of like about that moment where you're like you try to just like do something wild in a relationship and you know just like this like last ditch effort of you know like this is probably not working, let's have sex in the street, and then when you're having sex in the street it's just like this is really not working. Yeah, like that's kind of the moment you're like, okay, that didn't work at all, like that's the end of that. But yeah, that song I wrote about like a total shithead who just was in this position where he had a successful first record and we started dating off of when he started, you know, when he released his second album, and it didn't go as, you know, went from playing to thousands of people in Europe to like, you know, maybe like 40 people in Portland, Oregon, you know what I mean? The music industry is so fickle that way, and it's so scary as an artist to have watched a person go, many people go through that kind of cycle and you know, slowly await my own, maybe. But yeah, like, it was, I think that, you know, they were not in a good place, and you know, I was also kind of struggling to get a new band going because my college band had broke up, and it was a hard thing to recover from, and you know, I think we both needed support from each other that we were both too, like, egomaniacal to give. And he was kind of just like, well, you know, it doesn't really seem like it's working for you, so you should probably move on while I go figure out how to make my record work. And so, yeah, it's fun. I've been, like, you know, like, secretly, like, watching that band's, like, you know, social media followers. And I think by the end of next week, all of my platforms will have surpassed his, and it's very
it's a good feeling.
That's what it feels
so
good
petty.
To be petty.
Right.
No, but
right.
It's okay sometimes.
But I mean, all of I think We're most human. Of my success is just like really deeply rooted in a sense of revenge.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's every artist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe you should be a comedian. You seem to have that kind of darkness. Might just fuel your comedy.
Yeah.
In your next phase. Also, I want to ask you about Till Death, which is my favorite track on the album. Mm-hmm. That song, I mean, the lyrics are like, mm-hmm. they slice, like, yeah. But the song has like an almost doo-wop feel to it, you know, like a very retro sound. So how did you decide to marry those two things together?
I don't think it was a conscious thing. I came up with the piano line, and when I wrote the piano part, it felt really cheesy to me.
Okay.
And the way that I wrote the record was, I wrote a lot of it in the studio, and I had, you know, really, like, prided myself in being a fast writer, and one day went into the studio being like, okay, I gotta pop another one out today, and just couldn't, and I felt really stuck, and pretty much every time I write a song, if it takes a little while, it always really just freaks me out, and it's just, it's gone.
What's a little while for you?
Like a day, you know, like, or a couple hours, just like, it's not coming. Like, I've forgotten. I can never write a song again. That's too bad. So I had this like moment where I was just like, it's gone and I'm not going to be able to do it ever again. So I came back the next day and was just like, I'm going to write three songs, and then wrote one of them was this piano line. And one thing that made one of the many reasons that made Craig Hendricks an excellent co-producer was that he was in the other room, and I was like, is this cheesy? And he's like, no, it's great. It sounds like the Carpenters. It's great. And that's like enough for me to be like, it sounds like the Carpenters. So I kept going with it. And then I kind of just like married this, you know, long list of shitty things that I felt like happened. And every time I like would list like a shitty thing that happened in the last year, I would follow it up in the way that, you know, I had a partner that stood by me, or a thing that my partner did to support me through that or whatever. And I just, you know, I kind of, I was kind of, I'm hesitant to say this, but I kind of wasn't, and it's kind of Father John Misty-ish, where that it's like, he has a song where there's just like a long list of, mm-hmm. of shitty things mm-hmm. in the world. And I kind of liked that sort of listing element of that song, and it felt... Yeah. It felt good in that way. And I think that, you know, it just started on piano, and I wrote the vocal melody and the lyrics, and then, you know, the arrangement just kind of takes on a life of its own. I don't know why it ended up that way. I think that it feels like a song that's like very sarcastic. And I think it needed this like really melodramatic, sweeping, you know, like arrangement in the choruses with the horns and everything.
Yeah, it's
like
a real
be this like proclamation of love and you know from a pile of shit.
Right,
know?
Real juxtaposition, and it ends on a real like major chord, right?
Yeah.
With like the word Thanatopia, like which is the word I had to look up.
What does it mean?
Thanatophobia is a fear of dying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you have that. You're ending on that. And it's like, whew.
And then we have this like sort of manhole saxophone. when we looked for a saxophone player, I sent him like a clip art of like, or it's like a stock photo of a guy in like a fedora with like a steaming manhole beside him on like a dark street with like a saxophone in a suit. And I was like, this is the vibe. Like, can you bring it?
It was brought. When you wrote the line, while the cruel men continue to win, was that before Trump had won?
Mm-hmm.
I guess you wrote that before.
It was a month before, but he was running.
Mm-hmm.
That's a line that pops up a couple of times. I think it was like, it just,
It's in the air at that point.
It was in the air at that point. I was conscious of that for sure.
Yeah.
The record feels cohesive. Like, mm-hmm. And I don't know how much was conscious or sort of like happy accidents where, you know, things would go into each other sort of seamlessly. What's that example of like one song ends and there's little, like some crinkling sounds and then you start it that way. The next song kind of has that and you have some like just some ambient interludes and things like that. Was that all premeditated? Did you set out to have this overall sense or was it piecing things together and it worked out?
I think it was premeditated in the sense that I like it when albums do that. And I think that it just shows like an extra level of care when you do that, either live or on record. But then how they actually happened was definitely something that happened in the studio. Like, I think, what song is Roadhead? Is the second song, I think. There's like, we used a Juno 6 for a lot of the keyboard parts, and it was kind of an old guy that would have a very, very loud, like kind of distorted sound that almost sounded like an ocean. So I had, or like wind blowing. So, you know, you could hear the tail end of that, and instead of fading it out completely or trying to tuck it away, we were like, okay, well, let's Google the sound of, you know, some oceans and just like have it wash into the next song.
Like touches,
you know,
like that are so nice.
Yeah.
And the... You know, often the way we consume now is single, single, single. And I love when you dive into an album and there's that thoughtfulness there.
Yeah, I really like, you know, it's a very like sort of outdated look at it.
Back maybe though? Would you say? I think.
I mean, I do. I'd like to believe
that more people are doing it.
Like paying attention to like the album as a form.
Well, I think that ideally it can operate as both, you know. I think that, like, especially last year you saw, like, these incredible albums from, like, Solange and Frank Ocean that were really, really long albums with a lot of really personal voice memo recordings and weird little skits that just felt so, it just sucked you into this album. You know, I think especially for artists on that level where it feels like they're so, like, unrelatable because there's so something so perfect about them, having these kind of, like, lo-fi touches of, like, these voice memos or these, like, you know, like, your recordings of you know, your mom talking or whatever, bring you into a world that you maybe doesn't feel like completely maps onto
the glossy production gets stripped away a little bit. Yeah.
So how are you going to spend the rest of your downtime before tour?
I'm directing.
What's on the to-do list?
Yeah, so much. It's horrible. there's a couple of, because when I record a record, I don't think about the live sound until later on. Mm-hmm. It takes a bit of time to transpose that because there's a lot of instrument, you know, we can't bring a full, you know, horn section on this tour and we have to figure out how to bring it out and with four people. So we're going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we can play Till Death live. And
just that one song, is that the trickiest?
Till Death is a little tricky just because there's a lot of of horns and it doesn't work so well when it's on a track or a MIDI, so we have to kind of take some time. It's also a really hard song to sing. It's really, really high.
It's very high for you, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually did that vocal take laying down because you, Craig said that it could help if I laid down to take it. So either I'm going
to fly
out
to learn how to right that way. That would be amazing.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
That'd be sad. I don't know. I don't know.
You know what's hard, though, about people who do that? If you're standing further in the back, you can't see them.
Yeah, but that's okay.
It is okay.
It's like, it's a moment.
Well, then it's like a religious thing. You're like, where is this voice coming from?
We'll just like roll out a cot for me to like flop over onto to sing that song.
That's a new stage diving is people just like carrying you around rolling on your back to a cot.
Yeah, I'm in my late 20s now. I gotta lie down for this one.
Yep.
So yeah, we have to do some practice with the live band, and then I'm going to direct a music video for another artist for the first time, which is really exciting. So
that's a
huge thing. And then I'm also editing the third video for this record, which is largely what I've been doing for the last 2 days. It's I like had this sick idea that we should incorporate stop motion. So I just spent 8 hours yesterday creating 12 seconds of content.
Yeah.
And then I spent 8 hours the day before.
What is it?
Well, in the last 2 days I spent 16 hours of making 27 seconds of content. It's insane. And then today my like computer was acting up and I was like, don't do that to me, you fucker.
God.
But yeah, I'm
painstaking.
You're actually editing yourself?
Me and Adam are editing side by side, and so he'll do his stop motion stuff and I'll do my stop motion stuff, and it's really just kind of like to be there and for moral support.
Yeah.
To just like be like, are you okay over there? Yeah. Like I'm okay. I'm going crazy.
So you direct and edit?
I didn't edit any of the other videos. Adam, unfortunately has to get roped into editing.
You have these skills in your wheelhouse.
Definitely more so now from the last 2 days. I studied video production, and I did work with Final Cut in college, but no one uses it anymore. So I've been learning how to use Premiere, and for the first time on the Roadhead video, because I think that ideally it's good to have like the director and the DP not edit, and like to bring in someone who hasn't
fresh eye,
and also someone who isn't like so married to the material, just like has no idea that we spent five hours to build a rig to make a shot, you
right.
know. If it doesn't make sense, you have to kind of just, I feel the same way about mixing a record. I think it's good to like have two people get it to where they think is as far as they can go, and then have someone who has no idea what went into it to come in and take it to as far as they think they can go with it. I think that ideally we will someday work with an editor, but for now I just beg Adam to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, for Roadhead, I think that a big thing for me is I really like, as a director, like finding really special moments, and so a lot of editing for me that I helped out with for the first time in Roadhead was just like scrubbing through all the footage and finding some 2 second moment where it's just like that something happened there that's like really, really lovely that needs to find its way into the edit.
Totally.
Everyone should check out Roadhead. It's an amazing, hilarious video, and also sad, and it's all the emotions, it's all the feels
all
for that. It's
just rainbow of emotions.
Monster.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites to make for sure. It felt like I really had kind of figured out what I wanted to do in a real way.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So when is the next album coming out?
By your own
timeline, you're late on it.
Oh yeah, no, I think that
you're slacking.
Like, there's no way I can follow up this album with a new one next year. I think I'm gonna wait a full one for that.
That's good.
But I have a lot of creative projects that I want to work on before a new record, and I have no idea what I want to say yet. You know, I'm pretty like content in my life, and you know, I just don't want to.
You don't think you can write when you're content?
I think I can. I just think that I have to go in it. You know, these last two records were so rooted in like trauma and some real shit that I don't really. I would love to write a record that's not about that.
Yeah.
And I have to reconfigure my process to do that, I think.
Totally. Well, I wish that for you.
It's a good place.
Yes, yeah.
Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm happy to be here for sure.
Nice.
Sweet. All right, Michelle, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
guys,
you.
Soft Sounds from Another Planet Oof. Is one of the best albums that has come out
Definitely.
Lately. And you should check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
it's
you.
It's awesome.
Special.
Thanks, Michelle.
Teach me to breathe. Teach me to move. PTSD. Anxiety. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.